WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Stephen McCauley. His observational humor hooked readers of his first two novels, The Object of My Affection and The Easy Way Out. Reviewing his new novel, The Man of the House, in The Washington Post, Kevin Allman wrote, "Stephen McCauley puts the fun into dysfunction. His specialty is creating characters who are stuck in dead-end relationships, stuck in dead-end jobs, stuck trying to meet their family's expectations and their own, all the while making their messy lives seem very, very funny." The Man of the House is about a gay man in his mid-30s named Clyde, who teaches literature in an adult education program he doesn't much respect. He hopes each day for a letter or something that will transform his life into the perfect life. Clyde lives in an apartment building in Cambridge with a roommate who's very attractive and straight. Here's a reading from the beginning of the book in which Clyde describes himself.
"I had almost complete privacy. I'd moved in with Marcus 2 years earlier, after the breakup of a relationship, desperately longing for and dreading privacy. There's a fine line between the gorgeous luxury of not having to account for your time and the loneliness of knowing that no one cares what the hell you do with it. And some days, most days, I suppose, I wasn't sure which side of it I was on. As I walked past the bureau I had wedged into one corner under the eaves, I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror and stopped short. The problem with having a housemate as handsome as Marcus was that I sometimes took his face as standard issue. Then I'd walk past a mirror and have to suffer through the comparison. It wasn't that I had any desire to carry around the burden of Marcus's languid blonde beauty. It was just that lately, the few things I'd once considered assets in my appearance were beginning to work against me. The lean and hungry, unkempt and addled look I'd cultivated throughout my 20s was beginning to read like desperation and indigence as I stepped into my mid-30s. At a certain age, the unkempt and hungry look is attractive only if you're neither, and the truth is, I was at least a little of both. Even my eyeglasses were turning against me. Almost daily, the black, clunky things I'd been wearing for years appeared less and less East Village and more Steve Allen. I'd chosen them years earlier as a fashion statement, but I'd made a mistake, and now it looked as if they'd chosen me. The depressing part was I was stuck with what I'd made myself into, and I couldn't pretend that it was only a matter of minutes before I turned everything around and started getting expensive haircuts and flattering eyeglasses. Some things have to be hammered out in youth. Past the age of 33, no one ever becomes stylish, any more than he takes up smoking or develops a passion for John Steinbeck. Besides, considering the astonishing number of people I knew who'd been plowed under before making it out of their 20s, aging felt like a privilege, the kind of privilege you should complain about only in private."
That's Stephen McCauley reading from the first chapter of his new book, Man of the House. Well, Stephen, how do you think you physically compare to the character you just described?
In reality or my self-image?
Well, both. Oh, let's do both.
I hope I'm not quite as bedraggled as that character, and I don't wear glasses, so that's one major distinction. But I suppose I sometimes feel that way, you know, like a little bit over the line in certain ways, you know, like I should have changed styles a while ago, or I wish I had done this in my youth. And
no, I have to describe the picture on the back of your book. You're wearing a striped shirt, a tie, and a vest, and you're posed lying down on your stomach with your head supported on your bent arm, and looking pretty attractive. And there's something about the language of that pose that looks to me like it's meant to read, you know, hunk. You know, like. Do you know what I mean? Like that. This is a pose that's
the magic of photography.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering how you feel about that pose, because the self-image of the character in the book is so, he's so insecure about his looks and everything, and there's so much security in a pose like that.
Well, I mean, it's relatively easy to feel secure about the way you look for the split second that it takes to snap a photograph. And so for that split second, I guess, you know, I felt secure because the photographer was saying, "Oh, you look great." And, you know, that's great. That's terrific. But Most days I walk around feeling much more like my character, Clyde.
Now, in your book, Man of the House, the main character's mother has recently died, and he's now trying to resolve his relationship with his aging father. Now, I understand you wrote this book after your father died. Did you have a strained relationship with him the way your character does?
I did. My father's a very different kind of person from the man in the book, who is a completely unyielding individual who doesn't really have a whole lot going for him. He lives in the basement of the sister's house, and he's unrelentingly critical. And that wasn't the case with my own father. On the other hand, we did have a very strained relationship. And up to the time he died, I thought, well, we're really going to resolve this relationship. We're going to make up all of our differences and have some kind of, I suppose I was thinking, frankly, you know, deathbed reunion kind of situation. But it never happened. And I realized after that time that, in fact, the relationship had been resolved. It had been resolved all along. It just wasn't one that I could accept. It wasn't a resolution that I could accept.
What was the resolution?
Well, truly, the last thing that my father said to me, he had been sick for a long time, and not a long time, had been sick for a couple of months, and I'd been somewhat involved in the caretaking at the end, and one day, as I was leaving his room, he said, "Will you please get a haircut?" And I said, "No, I won't," and that was the last exchange we ever had, and I felt very sad about that for a long time, and then I realized, well, that had kind of been a lot of what our relationship had been about, is, you know, trying to impose his will on me and me resisting and neither one of us yielding very much. And so it seemed almost perfect in a way.
You know, in the novel, when the main character's mother dies, the father calls him up and says, "Get a haircut." And and the son says, why are you telling me this? And he says, well, your mother died and you'll need a haircut for the funeral. But that's right. That's his real clumsy way of breaking the news. I guess that's a play on what actually happened to you, that the last conversation you had with your father was about a haircut.
Yeah. And I imagine this family in the novel, like all families that have a certain degree of dysfunction, to use that word, of having contorted lines of communication, you know, where you say one thing and you mean something else. And the only way the father can really begin to even talk about the mother's death is through this command, you know, get a haircut, and then as if the mother's death is almost parenthetical to that.
Are you comfortable writing about your father in this way? I know you're not literally writing about your father, but the father in this book is patterned at least in part on your father. So do you feel guilty that you're not, you know, casting him in a more heroic light? Writers have a hard job.
Well, I'm pretty clear about who the character is and who my father is and what my relationship with my father was and what the relationship in this book is. You know, I really do make a pretty clear distinction. So I don't feel as if I'm writing about my father. I certainly feel as if I'm writing from a lot of the feelings that I had about my relationship with my father. But, you know, once I begin putting a character down on the page, he or she takes on a life of his or her own. And so I don't really feel like I'm writing about my father. I'm certainly not writing a portrait of him. Any more than I'm writing a portrait of myself.
The mother in your novel, in the last year of her life, dreams up these bizarre recipes that approach science fiction. She saves them in a shoebox, which the main character discovers. How did you come up with this conceit?
Well, I spend a lot of time shopping at thrift shops and church basements and rummage sales, and you always come across these, you know, and basically I'm looking for books all the time, and you always come across these spiral-bound cookbooks that have been put together by the Kiwanis Club or the Ladies Auxiliary of something or other, and they're these really strange recipes that people send in, you know. And my favorite one was one called Coke and pie cherry salad. And it was this really amazing concoction of Coca-Cola and, you know, cans of cherry pie filling and on and on. But in the middle of it, there was the ingredient was 1/4 teaspoon water. I just thought, what purpose could this possibly serve, this 1/4 teaspoon of water? And after, you know, having a lot of belly laughs about that, I realized that the book had been printed up many years earlier, and that the person who had written that recipe was probably dead. And, you know, and she came alive to me somehow or other in some strange way. I guess it was the writer in me, you know, that thought, well... And I found something very touching in that someone had sat down and put this crazy recipe together and made this stab at immortality. And that's what I wanted to give the mother, you know, that she was this rather unhappy person writing these completely insane recipes like tuna cookies and no-bake meatloaf. And but it was really a desire to create something for her kids and for the future. And she also annotates them with all these comments about, oh, these are great for the family when they sit down on the weekend, and, you know, all things that never happened in her family.
You're in your life more successful than Clyde, your character, is. He's you're in a long-term relationship. He's not. You've taught writing at Harvard and Wellesley. Your character teaches at The Learning Place. And he describes this as courses that manage to sound both intellectually challenging and embarrassingly trendy, like Haute Cuisine for the Hungry Heart and the Peter Pan Syndrome in the novels of George Eliot and Gail Godwin. And you're a successful writer, and your character doesn't even have that ambition. So tell me about writing about a character who hasn't achieved what you have.
Well, you know, I have a lot of trouble writing, and I'm very critical of my own work, and I think that's why I write rather slowly, is because every sentence I put down on the page, I immediately think, oh, you know, God, that's so horrible, and how could I have written that? And so I often feel like that character who is as underachieving as he is, and then I have to remind myself, no, well, wait, I have written 3 novels, and, you know, I have had a successful teaching career and so on. But it's not something that comes natural to me. I mean, I have to remind myself of those things. My deeper instincts are to think, you know, I'm teaching Haute Cuisine for the Hungry Heart, and can't really get out of bed in the morning, and, you know.
Well, I read in your bio that you've actually done a lot of odd jobs over the years, and I imagine you've done these because you needed to make a living and weren't making a living from your writing. So you want to run through some of the jobs that you've had over the years?
Well, let's see. Most recently, I worked for about 7 years off and on as a travel agent, which was somewhat disastrous because... I mean, among other things, I really don't like to travel, and my second novel.
Perfect.
Yeah, it was a perfect job. And then it led to a travel column that I used to write, which was also somewhat disastrous because I was always writing about people's horrible vacations and, you know, the bad time they were having, and that column didn't last too long. But, oh, God, what else have I done? I mean, you know, the kinds of jobs that people do when they haven't really settled into anything resembling a career and are just trying to get by. And for me, I think what I was really trying to do is avoid sitting down and writing because it seemed like such an audacious ambition to want to write a novel, you know. So I spent a lot of time selling vitamins and, I mean, you know, the list goes on and on.
My guest is Stephen McCauley. He's the author of the new novel, The Man of the House. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen McCauley. His novels include The Object of My Affection, The Easy Way Out, and a new novel called The Man of the House. In your new novel, the main character's homosexuality it's just not an issue. It's just, I mean, he's gay and period. You know, there's no struggling over gay identity and all of that. Did you ever write a novel... in which there was that struggle?
No, not really. In all three of my novels, the sexuality is just a given. And, you know, it's not to say that it's incidental in any way, because given the society that we live in and, you know, I mean, just the politics of being gay, it's not possible to have a character who just happens to be gay without there being consequences. And so there are consequences in these characters' lives, but I wanted to pick up their life at the point at which they weren't dealing with whether or not they were gay and what that meant and should they come out to their friends or not, but where they'd worked through all of that. And it was something that was integrated into their personality and was just another thread, you know, in the fabric of their lives, I guess.
Now, let me ask you, when I really just admire the humor in your writing. And I'm wondering if you ever write a sentence and it comes out serious, and then then you kind of rework it. I mean, do you find the humor in things every step of the way?
Yeah, you know, for me the challenge is to make it sound very conversational and make it sound very fluid. But that's not the way
it actually happens.
Yeah, it actually happens. And I suppose it's like doing, you know, comedy, live comedy or something, that the timing is really important. And when you're writing a sentence there, depending on how many words there are in the sentence or the whole tone of it, just changes whether it's funny or not so completely. So it takes a lot of struggle for me. I'm not a good dinner conversationalist where I can come up with these witty things, but mm-hmm. because it takes 2 years or more to write a novel, for me to write a novel, I can always go back and change things and make it funny.
Now, I'm wondering if you can think of a specific sentence in the book that you worked on a lot and transformed, and, you know, you're really happy with the way it came out, but it took a lot of work to get it there.
Yeah, I can, but maybe if I say it, it won't sound funny, and they say, well, boy, he should have worked on it longer, right? But there was one sentence where he's describing the downstairs neighbor, and let me see if I can find it.
Good.
Oh, yeah. The downstairs neighbor, the man with the hair clinic, is very uncomfortable in Clyde's presence. And Clyde says, Donald always went through the showy routine in my presence out of what I assumed was a combination of self-consciousness, lack of social skills, and discomfort at being trapped in a confined space with a known homosexual. And I had written that basically just to say that he was uncomfortable with me because I was gay, and that didn't seem funny. It just seemed like a statement of fact. And somehow putting it at the end of that sentence and, you know, a known homosexual, just the number of words so that that last phrase came out as kind of a punchline almost, is one sentence that I, you know, struggled with for a while till it felt like it was the right tone.
Mm-hmm. How hard was it for you to start writing? Like, when did you, how old were you when you decided to really take a serious stab at it?
I think I was about 27. And for a long time, that's what I wanted to do. But, you know, I avoided it. And so when I was about 27, and I've been working at a travel agency for a number of years, and nothing really seemed to be engaging me, I thought, well, what have I got to lose, really? So I got together some stories that I'd written, and I went off to one of these graduate writing programs. And that's really where I began writing my first novel, and it worked out very well for me. I think it worked out well for me because I could tell people I was in graduate school, you know, and I was writing my thesis rather than saying I'm writing a novel, which sounds so grand to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Something I really identified with, you write, I'd gone from feeling at a disadvantage because I was younger than those in authority to feeling at a disadvantage because I was older than those in authority.
Yeah.
Tell me about that feeling and when you felt you switched from being younger to being older.
Well, you know, I always felt at a disadvantage in the world because I would look around at, you know, people and say, oh, everyone's so much older and more mature than I am. And then I think it was one point while I was teaching, and I realized that I'd been teaching for a number of years, and I always assumed that I was about the same age as my students, even though, in fact, they were 10 or more years younger than me, but we had a lot of the same points of reference and, you know, cultural interests and so on. And I think it was the last year I was teaching, I kind of looked out at this class one day and I realized that I don't have anything in common with these people anymore. I'm of a completely different generation. And I just wondered where that middle period had gone, you know, when I was the right age to be in some kind of position of authority. And I don't know where it went.
Do you feel any more comfortable being clearly older than you did feel when you were younger?
Yeah, I like feeling a little bit older and feeling like I have less to prove in some strange way.
Well, Stephen McCauley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen McCauley's new novel is called The Man of the House. This is Fresh Air.